The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Hey, welcome along. Bit tardy there. Forgotten how to open the microphone, which is the absolutely essential thing you have to do here to get the show underway. And we don't want any more technical fiascos like we had last time. I don't believe in the charm of amateurishness, as I've said before, so we like to keep it brisk and professional here. It's the last day of September 2021, a little too autumnal for me, meteorologically speaking, where I happen to be. I hope it's a little more agreeable where you are. It's 11 a.m. North American Eastern Time, midday in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, half past noon in Newfoundland and Labrador, 4 p.m. in the British Isles, 5 p.m. in Western Europe, 6 p.m. in the Bosphorus and the Levant, 7 p.m. in the Trucial States. We had a Trucial Stater check-in with us last week and delighted to have his question. So, Trucial Staters, don't be shy. Don't just leave it to one guy in Dubai. All of you leap in. We'd like to have every Trucial State represented. And of course, it's 7:30 p.m. in Kabul, as we can now say. We pretended it was called Kabul for the 20-year U.S. occupation, but we're now going back to Kabul, where 87% of the population are U.S. translators. So by now, they're all probably at Fort Bliss and Fort McCoy. Lovely to have you with us. You know how this works. Anywhere on the planet, all 7 billion specimens of humanity are free to listen. You only have to be a Mark Stein Club member to ask a question, but we'd be delighted to have your company in the club. And if you're a newbie, we'll be sure to get to your question and to stake it out in particular. Let's get to our first question. It's from J.M. 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 says, I'm a millennial and new member. I read your books in college and learned more about global economics and politics than from most of my overpaid professors. Well, that's damning with faint praise, J.M. You're a new member. So I'll let it go this time. I don't want to be compared to any rinky-dink professors at the depraved academy in America or elsewhere in the Western world. In After America, you described the issues from the glut of oversupply of housing. I think I was actually talking, unless I've forgotten something very basic, I think I was talking about the excess of office supply of commercial business property, which is certainly the case now. I think I gave the example in Greece, where if you build a parking lot expecting traditional mid-20th century birth rates, so you're expecting 100 cars in the parking lot, and because Greece's birth rate has collapsed, you've only got 30 cars in the parking lot and attendant office space. That's all true now, of course, with the number of people who've gotten used to working from home and have no desire to go back to the office and are fearful of going back to the office. And whatever they're doing in those office buildings, all the businesses around them depend on servicing the people in the offices, all your Starbucks and whatnot, and your what's the big UK chain? Pret-a-manger, wraps. And if no one's coming into town, no one needs your crappy rap. So all the cheap service jobs, which is what Americans in particular have been left with since all the non-service jobs were shipped to China, nobody needs those. You're not buying all your $5.89 macchiatos if you're working from home. You're just making a cup of crappy coffee from Folgers or chock full of nuts or whatever it happens to be. Anyway, so I think that's the bit in After America. But did I say anything about home prices? I can't remember. My books don't even stick with me, never mind anybody else. But JM continues, now there seems to be a shortage of housing. Mortgage rates are low, so everyone is getting multiple homes, as well as private equity firms buying up whole neighbourhoods. I believe a lot of my generation has now been priced out of buying a first-time home. This will cause a long-term ripple effect for future generations. It's hard to see a scenario of shifting back to too many homes and not enough buyers. How do you see this panning out? Yeah, I think, for example, Australia has always had a problematic situation. It's a very desirable country to live in. Until it became a prison state, obviously. Well, no, originally it was a prison state. Then it became a very desirable country to live in. And now it's gone back to being a prison state. But one of the problems it always had is that its cities were among some of the most expensive housing markets in the world. So it was very hard to get a foot on the ladder there. And very hard, for example, and when you... It's not just about having somewhere to live, but about having somewhere to live that enables you to start a family. So, for example, if you live in expensive property markets, like those parts of London, I think it came up in The Prisoner of Windsor. There's a little thing there about somebody converting a storage locker into a kind of studio apartment. Which goes on in South Kensington. And of course, you can live in that, but you can't live in that and raise three children in that. And so an inflated property market works against what's the phrase? Affordable family formation. And that's the situation that the United States, in some of its more desirable places, and even, you know, Vermont, the COVID has distorted all that. Vermont, any old crap can sell in 20 minutes because so many New Yorkers are fleeing to Vermont. So many people from Massachusetts are fleeing to New Hampshire because of the COVID. So if you've got a broken down, rusting double wide or in Enosburg Falls, hard by the Quebec border, you can probably find some New Yorker to sell it to for $750,000. So we have a very distorted property market that isn't going to settle down until we know what our life is. You know, in other words, this time last year, it was still just about possible to believe that we were seeing a temporary disruption after which normal life would resume. It's now clear that normal life isn't going to be coming back, that something new will emerge. And whether that something new permits affordable housing has yet to be seen. But the way it's looking is it doesn't. I mean, one thing, for example, if you're doing some of these cubicle jobs, if you're doing some of these so-called the middle class jobs where you realize, well, wait a minute, I don't have to go in. What with all the Zooming and the internet and everything, I don't actually need to get on a train and go into Midtown Manhattan and walk 12 blocks from the subway station and then take an elevator up to the 27th floor. I can stay in my home and do that. And that means that's fine. Might mean you start thinking in terms of having a bit more space for your home office. It might mean that, as JM says, you start thinking about buying multiple properties because you might want a second home just to keep your home office in. You might want your vacation home to be a little bigger than you were planning, not just a cabin, because you're planning on working from there too. Here's where it gets disturbing to me. And it goes back to what I was saying about affordable family formation. Oh, by the way, there will be large parts of America you will be able to buy a home in. Whether they're parts you'll want to live in is the real question. That's the big issue. But one of the things it's likely to have an effect on. Now, you say you're a millennial, JM, and I can't work out all these generations and things. As my dear old dad used to say to me when he'd catch me listening to some hideous rock concert album, and I'd be saying, "Oh man, give me a break, man." Your generation just doesn't get it. And he used to say, I don't know what you're on about. People didn't used to think generationally. What kind of music is it that only appeals to somebody born between this particular date and that particular date? So he didn't like to think generationally, and nor did I. Nor do I, because the fundamental things apply as time goes by. And one of the fundamental things that applies is if it's hard, the way JM puts it is, a lot of my generation has now been priced out of buying a first-time home. And this will cause a long-term ripple effect for future generations. Well, the most interesting question about that is whether there'll be future generations. There won't be as many future generations it will be later. Affordable family formation will come later. So the effect of people not being able to get their rung on the first home they ever own, they'll have to be renting a flat for longer, or they'll have to be living with mom and dad for longer, or whatever, is that ultimately you stay a child longer. And all those things that lead toward a conservative disposition, such as owning your own home and being aware of the costs of garbage collection and of making sure your well keeps functioning, and all the things that go with owning a home, which aren't necessarily terribly interesting, but they're part of what it means to become a grown-up. And as I said, particularly being able to afford a home on which you can raise a nice family. All that's going to be deferred. So when you talk about the ripple effect for future generations, instead of those future generations being born when you're 23, 25, 28, they're going to be born when you're 32, 34, 39. You'll have fewer of them. It's the old thing, as we know, when we look at demographics in Yorkshire or whatever, that the white yuppie couple has one boutique designer infant with the aid of fertility treatments at 39, and the cab driver from Mirpur in Pakistan has seven children or whatever. So these things make the difference. Ultimately, it's how many if these plucky young Haitian lads who are all welcoming into our homes, or these Afghan translators. I mean, my only ambition for my daughter is that she settle down with a nice Afghan translator. They'll all be practicing their fertility rates, and in this case, it's likely to lead to even less affordable family formation, and more to the point, keeping people with childlike attitudes longer. JM, and beyond that, if you're one of these people who's all excited about the midterms, because Joe Biden's making such a mess of it, and you're all excited. I mean, it's going to be just a Republican sweep in November 2022. Well, no, it might not be, because one of the effects of being maintained as a child, of being maintained in rental property, of living with your mum and dad, is that you develop conservative attitude. The Churchill line of whatever it is, being a liberal when you're 20 and a conservative when you're 40, that's likely to get deferred if you do not buy your first home until well into middle age. Brian from Minneapolis says, Dear Mark, any comments regarding Lieutenant... Oh, wait a minute, wrong country. Lieutenant Colonel Scheller. Thought I was north of the border. I'm pining... I'm pining for the Princess Patricias, having been out of my own country up there. It's like a closed off to me. I can't. They're never going to let me back in. The land of my birth is lost to me. Brian from Minneapolis says, any comments regarding Lieutenant Colonel Scheller being thrown into the brig for calling out his superiors' handling of Afghanistan? I wouldn't necessarily call thoroughly modern Millie his superior. He seems a rather inferior type to me. After the utter disgraceful and dishonourable escape from Afghanitraz by abandoning our citizens and Afghan allies while saving themselves and leaving behind an $85 billion gift package behind, the only ones who get punished are those who criticise it. In the end, it's all right for Millie to set up soldiers to be murdered in a terror attack in Kabul, but it's insubordination to question that order. Any thoughts on this, Mark? Yeah, when I first read that Colonel Scheller had been thrown in the brig, I thought whichever tweet I read it on was speaking metaphorically, that he'd been, because he's quit, he's had to quit the service and forego his pension, which I gather was $2 million. He's had to forego that. And so I thought people were just saying he'd been metaphorically tossed in the brig from all the bad press and having to resign. But no, he's actually been arrested and is under detention, like all those January 6th fellas who've been in solitary confinement for the entirety of this year. And it's interesting to me that Millie is a I mean, I was listening to these guys. Not really. I mean, I wandered in and out, so I heard collectively about 2 minutes of their testimony. But really, it was quite pathetic. Scheller is in the brig because, for the same reason that people get kicked off Twitter, Facebook, for the same reason that respected virologists have their videos removed from YouTube. He's in the brig because he's questioned the official narrative, and he's not allowed to do that. Now, one thing you learn about these things that ought to be encouraging is that these people are obviously insecure. You know, if they were confident that they can put this over on the American people, that somehow the official government position is that everything in Afghanistan went according to plan and they accomplished one of the greatest humanitarian. It's better than Dunkirk, because in Dunkirk they were just rescuing a lot of lousy Englishmen, Scotsmen, Irishmen, Welshmen, I think there were a few Canadians, early members of the expeditionary force, and one thing and another. They were just rescuing British subjects, pale, pasty, white-faced blokes. This is incredible, because never in history has anybody ever done a humanitarian lift of so many Afghan translators. We didn't get them all out, unfortunately. We didn't get any of the ones who can actually speak English. We only got the Afghan translators who are apparently expert from translating between Pushtun and Uzbek. But it's unprecedented. It's never been seen. The official version of events is that this was a triumph. As you know, if you heard our Thoroughly Modern Millie song, in the instrumental break, we play Thoroughly Modern Millie saying that they war-gamed every conceivable option before they put the plan into operation, and none of the hypotheses and speculative outcomes that they war-gamed foresaw what actually happened. They've got 37 different versions of events that didn't happen. Now, Colonel Scheller is not an idiot. I won't say every general, but huge amounts of generals are idiots. Nobody who actually had any care for the United States military's reputation would actually dress like General Milley. I mean, it's absolutely preposterous to have, you know, all those medals from shoulder to scrotum when in a country that hasn't won a war. There was people will recall I met, had dinner with the Duke of Edinburgh, a very agreeable and convivial evening. He was once obliged to visit some Latin American dictatorship. I can't remember which one it was. He told this story against himself, and it was rather funny. He met the El Presidente for life, and the guy was some generalissimo, and he had the General Milley look. He had all the ribbons down his chest. And His Royal Highness asked the general, he said to the general, he said, "Oh, did you give all those medals to yourself?" And the generalissimo made a rather droll comeback and he said, "Oh, did your wife give you all those ones?" Which was quite funny of him. But basically, General Milley is wearing, when a country is, when you haven't won a war in three quarters of a century, you are signalling by that amount of ribbonage that you're not serious. He's not serious. He's not serious. He's also a politicised general. The things he said, he's managed. A guy who didn't have time, apparently, to plan an orderly evacuation from Afghanistan that didn't lead to the return of the Taliban, never mind to dead servicemen and dead civilians, and droning the wrong bloody guy and killing all his kids. So the world's most lavishly funded military can't even skedaddle without bollocking up something for one of the poor son of a bitches left behind. I mean, it's disgraceful, Millie. And Scheller, here's the thing, Scheller spoke up against it. And so it's important to punish him from Thoroughly Modern Millie's point of view, from the military industrial grifters who've rendered the US military not fit for purpose, to use the tedious Britannic cliche. Not fit for purpose in terms of being able to invade places in and subdue them in an efficient way, or of defending the homeland. Because really, what do you need an army for if a bunch of Haitians can just walk into a place? If you're an undefended country that can't defend itself against COVID-positive Haitians, doesn't really need, and has had transformative immigration of the kind that California's seen in the last cut, doesn't really need an army. But that's why he had to be punished, pour encourager les autres. And to go back to what I always say about the FBI, you know, when certain talk show hosts, you know who they are, I don't want to mention their names because people keep having a go at me if I, you know, say, "Oh, we should all stick together." Yeah, we should all stick together and keep talking crap because that's really worked out great for us. So we have these people who say, "Oh, the FBI, the salt of the earth, oh, it's just a few bad apples at the top." No, it isn't. No, it isn't. Where's the FBI agent who says, "Wait a minute, what am I meant to be doing on January the 6th? No, thanks, I don't think I'm particularly keen to go along. Oh, wait a minute, what's this? You want me to fake up a plot against the governor of Michigan? Nah, I'd rather not get mixed up. Oh, what's this? You want me to go and stall on the news that the so-called noose left in the NASCAR guys... garage is in fact a garage door, Paul. You don't want me to put out to the press release saying nothing to see here, folks. None of these guys have resigned. They're a disgrace. The FBI should be scrapped. And if your crappy congressman isn't calling for them to be scrapped, he's not a conservative. He's an idiot. Now, or he's in on it. Now, here we have the same thing in the army. Imagine in the military. Imagine. If Colonel Scheller were to get away with it, if he were to get away with it, that's why he's got to be punished. That's why he's got to be put in the brig. They'll find something to charge him with. If they could, he's basically going to be, we're going to be, instead of Milley standing in a courtyard having his epaulets ripped off, I don't know whether they do that here, I'm thinking of the Dreyfus case. I think that's the last time I paid attention to epaulettes. It's been a long time. But epaulette-wise, Thoroughly Modern Millie's going to be keeping all his, and this poor colonel is the one who's going to have to get... Because they don't want to... You know, it would be a marvellous thing if every... If 200 of his comrades had said, "You know, you're right, we're tired." And if actually some of these poor fellows who've served in Afghanistan in the last 20 years had their limbs blown off, If veterans and serving men said to hell with you, it's not as if you're defying your command. He doesn't command anything. He's just the advisor to the commander in chief. He's a bureaucratized general. Anyway, that's why they've thrown him in the brig, literally, because it's pour encourage les autres. They don't want this kind of thing getting out of hand. Richard Mallaby says, "Hi, Mark. Love the club. Thank you for that. Truth be told, I'm recycling my unanswered question here from the September 16th Clubland Q&A, which I didn't get to. With the thrust of your argument the past few weeks, the Uniparty and failure of the Republican establishment, I thought it was still appropriate and relevant." Okay, so what follows is now, as they say on the telly, an encore presentation. It's like Nick at Night. It's like Nick at Night. I don't know whether they still have Nick at Night, but you used to be able to switch on and there'd be Ozzie and Harriet from 1958 flickering away. So this is like the Clubland Q&A equivalent of Ozzie and Harriet from 1958. "Like you and probably everyone here," says Richard Mallaby, "I loathe the permanent election cycle. Right now, there are races all across the country where multiple people have already declared their candidacy for November 2022. In my house district of NH1, I'm in NH2. You know, during the Obama stimulus, there were huge amounts of money that went to the 6th New Hampshire Congressional District. And it was up there at the website. We all were very startled by that because, as far as the rest of us were aware, there were only two New Hampshire Congressional Districts. There's the one that Richard is in, which is by the seacoast and then snakes inland to embrace the big cities of central southern New Hampshire. And then there's the second congressional district, which sort of snakes up through all the rural parts of the state to cover the big Great Northern Woods and the lakes up by the Quebec border. And I have no idea where this 6th congressional district was, but it's probably a bit of swampland by Wentworth's location, I should adjudge. And it managed to get all the money from the stimulus. Don't know what they did with it. Like you and I, you say, in my house district of New Hampshire 1, I believe there are 6 GOP challengers already lined up to face the incumbent Democrat. My question, how are we ever going to move away from this, from politics as a profession, the constant media attention and fundraising machine? There may be excellent candidates out there, but if they do not have any money and only begin campaigning a month before the primary, aren't they dead on arrival? All of your efforts are appreciated. Thank you." Yes. And again, I'd be interested in having the constitutional fetishists weigh in on this, because originally, with the presidency, the whole thing was that the office sought the man. The man did not seek the office. So candidates for the presidency, American presidency, for whatever it was, most of the first century of the Republic, they didn't campaign for it. They'd be nominated, and then they'd do nothing, and then Election Day would come around. And now we have a thing where we have the permanent campaign, and the campaign isn't about anything. The campaign isn't about issues. The campaign is about personality. It's about non-personalities getting enough money to be able to afford a consultant to create a personality for them. So like John Kasich created this personality that he was the son of a mailman. And that's all very fetching if you're attracted to politicians. No normal person is attracted to politicians. If we were going to have a permanent campaign, it would be better to have one in which we talked about real things. If we talked about the open border, if we talked about China, if we talked about the COVID. But we don't ever get that. We don't ever get that. We get, you know, and actually the total fraudulence of it is currently best embodied by my fellow Montrealer, Kamala Harris. She's actually got quite an interesting biography. She's half Indian, half Jamaican, raised in Canada. So she's even more of a British subject than Barack Obama was. That's quite an interesting and personal and particular story, but it's a bit too foreign for the focus groups. So instead they have to fake some pseudo, you know, they have to fit her into the totally clapped out, tedious race narrative of America instead of the, I'm a high caste Brahmin. married to a whose mom married into a hoity-toity Jamaican family, and I was raised in Westmount, which is the most Tony and Anglo part of Quebec. And that's too particular. So instead, you have to fake. That's Kamala's story. So we have a permanent campaign in which there are no issues, just personalities, and there are no real personalities. There are only fake personalities for the most part. You know, Lunch Bucket Joe from Scranton. Is in fact, you know, as we all know, Politburo Joe from Beijing. So we spend 4 years talking about fake autobiography. And I don't know what we can do about this. I think I'd be interested to hear from the constitutional fetishists. I think the system has been, and here's where the problem for me about the US Constitution, we know it can be perverted because the Democrats over the last century have wholly perverted it. What we don't know is whether it can be redeemed. In other words, whether you can get it back. And as I pointed out with the Canadian election, you know, we're all to elect the same crap people who all think the same and who are all driving Western civilization off the cliff. You can say what you like about the Canadians or the Australians, or whatever, but they get their crap governments in 6 weeks, you know, and for a thousandth of the cost. And for those 6 weeks, generally speaking, they are about the issues. They're not this, I'm proud to say I was the son of a mailman thing. I keep hearing these things from consultants, which is a class of people that shouldn't exist. One of the great things, if Trump could do this, Trump should actually set up a school that teaches what he did in the summer of 2015. Everybody had already entered the race and had spent all their money booking all the campaign ads. I had that email from Mike Murphy telling me that even if Trump were to win New Hampshire, it wouldn't do any good because he'd booked all the airtime between New Hampshire and South Carolina. And Jeb Bush wasn't even in the race by South Carolina. And he blew through $100 million in Iowa to get 2.4%. What we need, what Trump and Hope Hicks and Corey Lewandowski, I mean, Trump and Lewandowski are now on the outs because he's been putting it about to every woman he runs into contact with or whatever it is. But if you could go back to the Trump, Hope Hicks, Corey Lewandowski thing, where he spent no money, and funnily enough, the personality, this is what he got wrong in 2020, the personality. He was the big personality, and yet he was the only one talking about issues. I mean, are you really interested in Jeb Bush's personality? If you can find it. I'm not. Trump was the one who had the personality. He had all the glamorous ex-wives. He did the telly show. And yet he came out and he talked about immigration and Mexico's not sending us our best and the rapists. And he actually injected a real issue into the campaign, and I'd like Trump to come back and talk about the Trump of 2015, summer of 2015. What was it? June 2015. I'd like, when he came down that escalator, I'd like Trump, Hope Hicks, and Corey Lewandowski to introduce a masterclass. In what it is to just, and he spent no money in that campaign, so you can do it now. He did it because he already had brand name recognition, which means you probably have to be, I don't know how you have to be. Being known to people didn't help Larry Elder or Caitlyn Jenner in the Californian thing, but you have to be a... But that actually was fantastic. Just be, even as they try to make it all, oh, Trump's crap, Trump ties are crap, Macy stopped selling Trump ties, he was talking about immigration. An issue, imagine that. An issue in the permanent campaign of American politics. That's I'd like the Trump model to be applicable to more widely. That's the thing. I'd like it to be applicable. No one's ever been able to duplicate it, replicate it at the House level or the Senate level, but it would be extreme. That would be the easiest way to do it. Eric Dale says, "Hey, Mark and fellow club members, is it me or are the questions that matter settled less and less by public debate and consensus and no more or less ruled on by the very connected and privileged? 20 or 30 years ago, a big issue was coupling our economy with China's. This was fresh off the Tiananmen Square massacre and the end of the Cold War, so our elites were under no obligation to suck up to the Chai Coms. And nevertheless, they decided that a billion-plus Chinese population was too good a market to pass up, and now we don't even make our own drugs anymore. Flash forward to today, and we don't have a consensus regarding the vaccines for COVID, but the elites are going ahead and firing people or making them unemployable who dissent from the Democrats' current talking points of vaccines. I say current as the Democrats were more than happy to encourage and exploit vaccine hesitancy during the last election." That is very true, Eric. They're not in the least bit consistent because they know we live in a hyper-present tense culture. So, and again, this is the way the reactive school of political combat doesn't work for the right. Because they sit there, I can't believe that. These shows where they dig up some clip from Joe Biden in 1972 referring to some Negro shoeshine guy as boy, or and they think this is going, yes, this is, what has he got to say now? It's all, nobody... No, but the Democrats don't even have to be consistent with what they did last October. "I'm not taking that Trump vaccine. He's been working in his lab late one night. I'm not putting that Trump vaccine into my veins." You think it's anything? They play these Biden clips from the 80s, the 70s. They got some flickering silent movie of Joe Biden in 1917. driving the whips against his plantation. Well, it doesn't matter. They don't. Inconsistency isn't applied to the left. To get to the bulk of your point. One other thing before I get to the meat of it, Eric. A billion plus Chinese population was too good a market to pass up. That's not actually how they thought about it. China didn't have a market of a billion people. It had peasants who sleep with the pig in the living room because the pig is the most valuable item in the family. So China was not given the entirety of American manufacturing because Americans wanted to access the Chinese market. There was no Chinese market that these guys were interested in. They wanted, which is what's happened, China to make cheap crap. Instead of making it, instead of having a relatively sane profit margin by making it in Maine or Idaho, they wanted to make it in China and have an insane profit margin. But they wanted to make it for the American market, the Canadian market, the European market. They weren't interested in the Chinese market because there was no such thing 30 years ago. And so they wanted China to make stuff for the American market, for the Canadian market, for the Australian market, for the European market. And of course, what happened is that they so enriched the Chinese that China grew a middle class. So it was no longer just people with the pointed hats in the rice paddies. Instead, it grew a middle class that actually became a more valuable market for things like Hollywood films and the NBA and all the rest of it. But it wasn't a market. And the stupid moron Chamber of Commerce, right, thought we're just outsourcing the production. And that otherwise life will go on. It's just a cheaper method of production for the American and Western market. And, of course, that's ludicrous that you could do something like that and expect there to be no consequences. The only consequence, people thought, was that once they were making all this stuff to sell to Americans, they'd all suddenly become capitalists. And if they became capitalists, they would become lovers of freedom. So everything was wrong about that. It's stupid. Now they make everything we need. We're reduced to crappy service, low-paid service jobs, and the COVID has clobbered all those. Now, here's the thing. You want to know, this isn't something that's popular. If you'd actually said that, put that to people, and said, do you want to give China all our jobs? So your daughter, your town is dead. Main Street is dead because the mill closed, the factory closed. People who could get out got out. It's people who are left are the people who can't get out. And so your daughter now does the night shift at the Quickie Crap at the gas station on the edge of town, and your son's a heroin dealer, and you'd love to leave, but you paid $120,000 for your house and it's now worth $53,000. So you can't really do that because you wouldn't be able to afford to buy anywhere that isn't like where you live. And if you put that to people in those terms, they'd have said no. But it wasn't put to people in those terms. Now, so it's slightly different from what's happening with COVID. COVID's happening in the here and now. Its effects are being felt here and now. And as you say, there's no societal consensus. And again, there's no consistency. So the people playing all those clips of Joe Biden boasting about all his segregationist buddies in 1972 are missing the point, because if you were going to use that point, you'd say, well, look, these people, we were being told that these people are our frontline heroes. They're all on doing videos where they're like prancing around doing funky disco songs through the wards of the hospital to cheer us all up. If you're in the United Kingdom, every Thursday you had to clap for carers. There are frontline heroes, blah, 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 blah. And now in New York State and elsewhere, they're firing the frontline heroes. I'd had a... it's not a friend, it's a friend of a friend. I can't put it higher than that. But a friend of a very dear friend of mine who was in pain, I think this was Sunday. He was in pain and he went to emergency. And emergency said, well, you've got a bowel blockage. As you know, that's fairly routine, a bowel blockage. Lots of people get them. But you have to have it operated on swiftly or you die. And they said they didn't have the staff to operate. And I don't know whether that poor guy or his loved ones, if the loved ones could even get in there with him, I don't know whether they understood the implications of that they were basically saying, oh, sorry about that. So they basically were leaving him in emergency to die, which he did, because they didn't have the staff. Now, they didn't have the staff. There are two explanations for why they didn't have the staff. One is that the unvaccinated are causing all these hospitals to fill up with COVID patients. And the other is that the vaccine mandate has led to the resignations of large numbers of nurses, because a lot of these nurses, surprise, surprise, a lot of these nurses turn out to be into QAnon and all kinds of things, and a few of the doctors too. And it doesn't matter whether they're into QAnon or whatever, but for whatever reason, they didn't want to have the vaccine pumped into the thing. So last year's hero, and so this guy died. So last year's hero, because all these hospitals now are short staffed. So now we're being told, I think the governor of New York is saying that, oh, he's going to bring in foreigners. That's a concept I thought had been abolished in America. But apparently foreigners, she's going to bring in, the female governor of New York is going to bring in foreigners to fast track foreigners into the country. I don't even know how you can do that, because right now the normal track is that the foreigner wades across the Rio Grande, walks into the country, and a couple of days later he's being a super spreader in the middle of Kansas or whatever. But she's going to fast-track that process so that foreigners can be the doctors and nurses in New York Hospital. So last year's hero is now some crazy anti-vaxxer who has to be fired. There's no... These are... What I think you're getting at, Eric, is that these are post-democratic impulses. That we are no longer being governed... according to democratic norms, where sweeping changes require some kind of societal consensus. There's no pretense of that now. There is elite opinion. They, again, to go back to that poor colonel in the brig, the lieutenant colonel in the brig, that what there is increasingly a globally agreed narrative that permits for only relatively narrow local variations, and that anything counter to that narrative is not acceptable. And this time last year, by not acceptable, it meant that you would lose your Twitter account or your Facebook account, or you'd have your YouTube video taken down. Now it means you lose your livelihood. But as I've been saying for some years, we are entering the post-democratic era in which, you know, what's interesting to me, for example, again, between the Democrats and Republicans, because Trump, when he had Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell running Congress, nevertheless couldn't get any of his agenda through a Republican Congress. So he basically, the only way he could implement his agenda was by, what do you call the royal proclamations here? Executive orders. Yeah, it would have been very familiar to George III. In fact, it was one of the things that the colonial legislatures had against George III, in that royal assent for their laws would be delayed. But anyway, so now we have royal proclamation, government by royal proclamation, executive order, etc. And so Trump did all these great things by executive order, which were all undone by about 20 past midday on January the 20th by Joe Biden. The difference here is that when the Democrats do things like they did with Obamacare, they actually ram it down the gullet. They don't care whether they're getting lousy poll numbers for it. They figure they can ride that out. People will forget. And so they go ahead even after Scott Brown gets elected to Ted Kennedy's old seat, and they pass Obamacare, and then it becomes almost impossible to unpass. And that's the difference between the Democrats and the way the Republicans do things. They're looking at changes in perpetuity. Changes in perpetuity. And they don't care, because it's the post-democratic age, they don't care about whether there's a societal consensus for them. It's like the climate change crap. And I think that's an interesting example. We didn't give it the significance because... What was so odd is that nowhere was climate change regarded as anything important. If you took polls, going back to the pre-COVID world, if you took polls, climate change came 19th on people's list of concerns. This is despite the propaganda. This is despite it, Al Gore's movie being shown to grade schoolers and all the rest of it. Nowhere in the Western world did the public evince any great urgency about climate change. Yet something happened. Something happened in that not just the left-wing parties, but the right-wing parties too. David, so-called right-wing parties, David Cameron's Conservative Party in the UK, Malcolm Turnbull and the gang down in Canberra, this idiot Erin O'Toole in Canada, and a not insignificant number of Republicans in the United States, somehow, countering climate change became too much to expect, and then being enthusiastic for it, like the way my old chum Boris is, became de rigueur. And the reason for that, obviously, is that you couldn't really be a fully fledged member of the Davos jet set if you were skeptical about climate change. And this was all, as I say, I'm now talking pre-COVID. And that became true of other things, which is by elite opinion regarded leaving the European Union, for example, as complete vulgar proletarian assholery. And they were, you know, Nigel Farage was welcome to all those ghastly people because it meant they'd be bending his ear instead of hectoring David Cameron about it. So on certain issues, we came to an understanding at the highest levels of Western societies that everyone should agree on certain issues, and that and that goes for immigration too, by the way. Immigration, it's not just that Republican voters are overwhelmingly opposed to at least illegal immigration and not terribly enthusiastic about legal immigration, mass legal immigration, but so are significant numbers of Democrats, including the ones who switched from Obama to Trump in 2016. And yet we'd sort of accepted a situation where it was normal for the political class not to recognize public discontent on so-called vulgar issues. You had it in Europe, for example, with capital punishment. The masses liked capital punishment. The masses liked it when a guy who killed kids got hanged or guillotined. And instead, the elite said, you're just the rubes. You don't know about stuff the way we do. And gradually, one by one, we kept adding to the list of things that were sealed off from populist urges. They thought they'd done it with Brexit and the European Union. They thought the European Union was one of those things you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. They thought they'd done that. They didn't realize that something like Brexit was possible. And as I said, this was all before COVID. And we taught ourselves particularly, let Boris have his climate change thing. Malcolm Turnbull and all these Canadian squishes, let them have their climate change thing. Because it didn't matter. Because, you know, they just fuss around on the edges, purporting to worry about whether the Maldives would be underwater in the next century. And then came the COVID. And it was the same thing as the climate change. Yes, oh, urgent action to save the planet. Oh, I get it. It's in case the Maldives are underwater in the year 2137. No. Urgent action to change the planet right now. Stay at home. You can't go out. You got to go home. You can't go to work. You can't open your hair salon. You can't open your diner. You can't do nothing. We're not talking about the Maldives in the 22nd century anymore. We're talking about right now. They trained on the they got used to it on issues like climate change that weren't relevant to anything happening next Thursday. But it taught them, oh yeah, there's just the official version here. Climate change is happening, urgent action now. Think globally, act locally. Maldives underwater. Oh, here's something else now. Think globally, act locally. Okay, we're thinking globally and we're acting locally by shutting your hair salon. We are in the post-democratic era, and it's rampaging on very fast. And that's what's going on here. Bernadette Cahill says, what has happened to the writ of habeas? I love the name Bernadette. By the way, we should resurrect in memory of Rush some favorite the Rush list of favorite ladies' names, because Bernadette would be on one of them. Anyway, Bernadette says, what has happened to the writ of habeas corpus in current U.S. law with regard to the brutal detention by Biden of 600-plus so-called insurrectionists, none of them charged with insurrection? Yeah, why aren't we calling them the so-called trespassers? Basically, they're being charged with trespassing. No one's actually... The FBI... and the Department of Justice have said that there was no actual plot. So nobody was plotting an insurrection. So why are we still calling them insurrectionists? Anyway, Bernadette continues, imprisonment without trial, solitary confinement and beatings would surely qualify for attorneys to invoke the writ. It was used successfully in Wilson's equally brutal Democrat administration when women were imprisoned for peaceful picketing and protest outside the White House between 1917 and 1919 to win the right to vote. The night of terror, force-feeding Alice Paul 3 times a day, keeping prisoners chained, blocking up prison windows and threatening mental asylums constituted enough for attorneys to apply for habeas corpus back then. Has it been used now? If so, with what results? If not, what has happened to habeas corpus? I don't recall anything I've read in which any of these lawyers has actually gone and applied for a writ of habeas corpus. I think if we had, you know, real judges. We had some judge the other day who said, who actually reprimanded one of the defendants and rebuked him. He'd agreed to settle, I think, one of the January 6th guys in return for not getting a prison sentence. I mean, he's been in prison for all these months anyway. But he'd been forced to settle, and the judge was yelling at him, I don't really agree with this no prison term for you. You rose up against my government, and I love my government. And he said things that would be extraordinary. I hate it when judges do this. You know, judges are there to administer. Judges are not there to do that. I'll leave it at that. I heard some local judge. But anyway, habeas corpus, is Latin, you of the body, and it's actually meant for these kinds of situations. I mentioned on the show on Monday that in Australia you've got federal cabinet ministers calling for indefinite detention at Her Majesty's pleasure, as the expression goes in Commonwealth countries. And that is actually how habeas corpus arose, because it's an attempt to do an end run around the justice system, which is what's going on here, as Bernadette points out. Because the thing is, you're going to be charged. The charges are getting smaller and smaller because they couldn't make anything stand before when it comes before a jury. So they'd eventually be pleading trespassing. And as you can see, for many of these people, the police, the guards are opening the doors of Congress and ushering people through and into it. So that it would be very easy to apply for a writ of habeas corpus and get it, except for the corrupt judiciary, if they're like that guy I just mentioned. But certainly they should be doing it. Now, here's the thing. The reason they're holding them is to force those guys to settle. These are guys with no criminal record. They're basically, a lot of them are law-abiding people in late middle age. They can't afford big-shot lawyers, so I take it a lot of them are being represented by third-rate lawyers, and unlike, for example, the guys at Gitmo, I mean, the guys at Gitmo can get a better quality of lawyer than Donald J. Trump can, because no fancy-pants lawyer wants to take Trump's case, and every fancy-pants lawyer wants a piece of the Gitmo action. So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has a better legal team than Donald J. Trump. God knows what these insurrectionists have. But Bernadette is absolutely, and the reason is simple. It's because there's nothing worse than indefinite detention. I've had all kinds of people tell me this over the years, because you can't do that thing where you make the scratches on the cell wall counting down the days. Diana Mosley, the wife of the British fascist leader Sir Oswald Mosley, was detained and couldn't even see her kids freely because Desmond Guinness, her youngest boy, little boy, they thought he was like smuggling info in and out. So it was all very difficult, very unpleasant. But the thing she said was the worst was that she was detained indefinitely. So you didn't know. They locked the cell door and you didn't know whether you were going to be there for a week or whether you were going to be there like the Count of Monte Cristo forever. You just didn't, you had no way of knowing. And that's the worst of all things. I'm not making any moral judgment about the risk of having Diana Mosley at liberty during wartime or whatever, but I'm just making the point psychologically. Now here, we're not at war, and we have people, law-abiding people who aren't the wives of fascist leaders, and they've been banged up in solitary confinement. They've gone and said, can we be out on bail? Oh, no, we can't possibly let you out on bail. We have no way of knowing whether you'd immediately get back to planning another insurrection. And so what happens is these guys, and again, here's why people don't think of the writ of habeas corpus, Bernadette. Because they're thinking of a functioning justice system of which habeas corpus is a part. Wait a minute, you're detaining someone indefinitely? That's not right. Here you have a thing where trials are all backed up. So you take an already sclerotic trial system, which I know well because I'm in the District of Columbia court system and I've been there since 2012, and we're on our fourth trial, Judge, and he still can't give us a date for the trial. That's how crap it is, even before COVID backed up all the cases. Because you can't really have a criminal trial with a jury on Zoom, although they're gonna try and do it. So these guys are there, you know. So it's one thing to say bail would be a legitimate thing. If you say, well, no, you're too dangerous to bail, so you're going to have to stay in jail for the 6 weeks until your trial starts in mid-November, and that'd be one thing. But when you're sitting in jail and they haven't even set the date of the trial, and they haven't even had the scheduling conference to talk about setting the date of the trial, then all you know is that however this shakes out, you might well get a trial at the end of 2022 or mid-2023, and you'll be acquitted. And big deal, you'll have spent 2.5 years in jail anyway. It's an evil system. Evil. Evil, evil, evil system. And too many people have gone along with it. My friend from National Review, Andy McCarthy, who always defended this system. And it wasn't until Conrad wrote his book so you had an intelligent and informed man on the receiving end of US criminal justice, capable of writing about his own experience, that Andy started to think, oh, yeah. The process is the punishment. The process is the object is to ensure there's nothing left of you by the time they're finished. And you should be able to go and say, when I won the second CRTV trial, when they came against me the second time, I pissed on the American system relentlessly. And the judge seemed quite partial to it, actually. And I appreciated that. And I think that's what has to happen here. Someone serious has to round these guys up and bring a writ of habeas corpus thing, because the solitary confinement, imprisonment without trial, which is what it is effectively, it's just completely it disgusts me that. Kozak says, Mark, why is it that we are told America just can't manufacture anything anymore except for wokiness, but Germany can continue to manufacture actual things? I think this is a reference to a point I made a couple of days ago, where I said basically this is how it works. Everything mass is made in China. Upturn anything in your house that you didn't pay a lot of money for, and it says made in China underneath it. And everything boutique, everything premium. I can't remember the examples I used, but I think I said Italian, whatever it was, Italian shoes, German cars, French wine, English shirts, and drinkable beer. And a lot of the microbrewery crowd in America were getting on at me about that. It's just a general point, honestly. No need to be so touchy. Everyone's so touchy. Well, the reason for that is that basically America gave everything to China. And so that you now have a situation where American manufacturing has been moribund for a quarter century. And the question then is, how could you start to manufacture things again? Now, the cost of manufacturing is high in America because of the hyper-regulation. So you have to spend an awful lot of money on complying with things like the New York Bureau of Compliance, which I got into trouble with, before you can put a single dollar in an American worker's pocket. So there's all complications with that. Then there's the complication that all these places have been closed for a long time. You know all these things. I think a Littleton, New Hampshire, just near me, where the mills, these vast mills, have all been confirmed. One's actually got a microbrewery in the Shilling Brewing Company, I think it's called, in Littleton, New Hampshire. And one's got a little, you know, espresso place in, and one's got a therapeutic massage place in. But there aren't enough of those boutique businesses. So when you walk into these mills and the espresso place is on the ground floor, and the therapeutic massage place is on the third floor, and the microbrewery is on the top floor. You know, you're walking through an awful lot of empty space to get to these little local boutique businesses. So it's not enough. But when you've not been doing it for a quarter century, and when you have, you know, another answer to Kozak's point is that it depends on the quality, or it depends on your human capital. You know, initially, Angela Merkel wanted all the so-called Syrian refugees, the strapping young Mohammedans, to make BMWs and Daimlers. And then those guys discovered, well, in fact, your average Mohammedan refugee isn't very good at that kind of thing. You need do that stuff, you need a relatively sophisticated human capital. Now, we teach our kids crap in schools. We waste all our time. I just mentioned this morning that in the province of Ontario, they're making you teach how crappily Her Majesty's government treated Canadian Indians. They now teach it in first grade. What is that? You're 6 years old and you're being taught about how crap your country is. You're not being taught anything useful that would come in useful if you were to do any skilled manufacturing. And finally on this point, Kozak, I'll make the point that, you know, again, for the constitutional fetishists, you have to confront this. That this madness, the wokeness, is being led by America. It's being led by America with the British dominions hard on their heels, you know, the UK and Canada. and New Zealand and so forth, hard behind with the craziness. And generally speaking, the continentals are among the least insane on the planet about this madness. So again, a lot of it goes down, you know. There was an Indian, what's the big Indian car manufacturer? Anyway, he opened up in Britain. He took over an old British car plant. And he said, like, compared to the human capital in India, it's very difficult. When you take people, you know, when you take all the skilled people and make them become diversity consultants, I'm simplifying here, but not really. A lot of middle-class people completely waste their lives on non-jobs that do no primary economic creation. And then you take the less skilled people and you tell them to be baristas. It's actually quite hard then to suddenly get up a great manufacturing plant there. And they haven't done that quite as badly in Germany. It's all a bit, let's see, what have we got as a quick way to... Oh, yeah, here's what I was talking about. Michael Lindemood. He said, "Hey, Mark, the governor of New York is going to allow foreign non-citizens to take their healthcare jobs that are being lost because of the vaccine mandates. What is the end game? Is this the transformation that Obama talked about?" Yeah. Yeah, this is it. Basically, they have accepted the Zuckerberg view of the world, or the Bill Gates view of the world, that we're not just in a post-democratic age, we're in a post-work age, post-human dignity age, where there is no purpose to your lives. You'll be given an allowance and you'll be able to sit at... This last year and a half has been a good trial run. You'll be able to sit at home for a year and a half and watch Netflix, and they'll get more content on Netflix so you won't exhaust the watchable stuff as quickly as you have done. But that basically everything else is going to be done by other people. And this is the transformation that I think a lot of them, you know, they can't understand. And to a certain extent, it's been confirmed. You know, round here, around where I am, restaurants and diners and all kinds of places aren't open on Monday, Tuesday anymore because they can't get the staff. So they close for the less busy parts of the week. And the less busy parts of the week, oh, we're closed on Mondays and Tuesdays. Oh, we're closed Mondays, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Oh, we're only open on weekend evenings now. Because people have been paid, you know, just enough to make them content to stay at home. We are undergoing a fundamental transformation. A fundamental transformation. And I'm very sad and depressed at the way the wanker right just wants to react to that. Oh, what was the thing they were reacting about? Somebody did something goofy and they're all mocking him and owning the... going so sleepy. We're witnessing the fundamental transformation of society, and all the right does is react to, you know, this sort of surface flimflam. Anyway, the clock has rolled past midday here on the Eastern Seaboard. I've outstayed my welcome. We can't end on that depressing note. So here we go. Once upon a time, there was a lovely lady called Marion Ryan, and she was a very popular singer in the UK in the 50s and early 60s. And she had twin sons, Paul and Barry, and they formed a singing act. And Paul decided he couldn't handle being even a very, 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 very small pop star. So God knows what it would be like with the groupies and the narcotics if he became a huge, big A-list pop star. So he decided that instead he'd be a songwriter and write songs for his twin brother Barry. And one night, the actor Richard Harris invited Paul around to his pad for a party, and he played him the rough mix of a record he'd just made called MacArthur Park, as in "Someone Left the Cake Out in the Rain and All That" by Jimmy Webb. And Paul Ryan loved the way it was. So big and epic, truly epic. So he shut himself away for 3 days and wrote an epic of his own. And it was the second song he'd ever written, if I recall correctly. And they recorded it at the end of his mum's recording session in Portland Place, in central London, place I used to know very well. And because the song was so long, they only had time for two takes. And if you're one of the many rockers among our listeners, and you get a bit sick of hearing all the easy listening thing, because we like to have easy listening music and hardcore opinions, whereas the other talk shows have hard rock and easy listening opinions. Well, if you're one of the many rockers among our listeners, Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones are playing guitar and bass on this track. Paul Ryan died very young back in the 90s. His dear old mum outlived him. Barry Ryan died on Wednesday, still too young. Here he is with that great melodramatic epic his brother wrote for him. Number two in the UK, South Africa, Denmark, Norway, Austria, Yugoslavia, Mexico. Number one in Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Singapore, Rhodesia, France, Switzerland, Italy, Spain, the Netherlands, Belgium. And in the United States, big hit sound number 87.
Nice.
this is Mark Stein. We have a worldwide number one hit for you on Stein's Song of the Week this week. It was composed by a German, although a Croat, a Lebanese, Armenian, and a Brazilian Frenchman all claim to have written it. And despite all that Franco-Lebanese, Armenian, Brazilian, Croatian, Teutonic tussling, it was a blockbuster for the biggest American star of them all. He loathed it, by the way, but you'll love it. It's all coming up on Stein's Song of the Week, Sunday afternoon at 5:30.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.